Thanks for listening to Pod of Jake. I'm Jake. You can reach me anytime by emailing jake@blogofjake.com. I'm fortunate to have some sponsors supporting the show whose products I genuinely love and recommend. I'll start with a word on those so the rest of the episode will have no interruptions. I hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Levels. Levels uses continuous glucose monitoring to track your blood sugar in real time. It allows me to see the impact that everything I do has on my metabolic health so that I can optimize my diet and exercise accordingly. Wearing the Levels patch, I feel like I'm living in the future. There's this moment when you raise your phone to the back of your arm, it vibrates and shows your glucose level right on the screen. It's this instantaneous look inside yourself, an in-the-moment snapshot of what's going on inside your body. And while it's only showing one simple measurement for now, it's enough for me to see the future. And that's exciting. It's exciting because I believe that we can live meaningfully longer and healthier lives than we do today, and I believe technologies like Levels will help us to get there. Levels is currently running an exclusive beta program with a waitlist of over 100,000 people, but you can skip the line and join Levels today by using my link in the show notes, levels.link/Jake. Again, that's levels.link/Jake. This episode is brought to you by Aura. That's Oura. The Oura Ring, from my perspective, is the single best wearable on the market. I use it to measure my sleep, activity, and readiness on a daily basis. I bought my Oura Ring several months ago before talking with the company's CEO on the podcast. I haven't taken it off since. I believe what gets measured gets managed. So if you care at all about your health, which you should, you have to measure your sleep in order to manage it. Oura measures much more than just my time in bed. It tracks my REM sleep versus deep sleep, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability, my temperature, my activity, and much, much more. For $299, you can get your own Oura Ring on auraring.com. That's auraring.com. Auraring.com. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you, Avichil, for joining me on the podcast today. I appreciate you taking the time and have been looking forward to this conversation. You are an angel investor, a serial entrepreneur, and currently co-founder and managing partner at Electric Capital, early stage venture firm focused on crypto primarily. But would love for those who aren't familiar with you or Electric, if you could just sort of start off by telling your story, and ideally sort of as early as you're willing to start. It's always interesting.
Awesome. Good to be here, Jake. Thanks for having me. As you mentioned, I'm a co-founder and managing partner at Electric Capital these days. We invest in early stage crypto. My backstory, though, is, well, actually going all the way back to the beginning. I was born in India, moved to the US when I was a kid, with my parents, obviously, when I was about five. So I grew up mostly in the US, kind of all over, Kentucky, Ohio, and then came to California for college. And then stuck around, and then spent most of my career as an entrepreneur, and was always interested in computers when I was a little kid. I was fortunate my parents didn't have a lot of money, but one of the things my dad did a good job of was they got me a computer. This was like 90s, and so, you know, they're pretty terrible. I got an old computer and I kind of learned how to tinker with it, and then I got a graphing calculator and learned how to program that thing. And so I was sort of always interested in just playing with computers and programming. Built a startup when I was in college, and scaled that up later after college and sold it. And then started another company that my co-founder Curtis and I sold to Facebook back in 2012. And then was there at Facebook from 2012 to end of 2016. So almost about 5 years. And then we kind of left, and I'd started dabbling in angel investing, as you mentioned, starting in like 2013, 2014, 2015, somewhere in there. And a lot of kind of like up the middle, like SaaS and marketplaces and fintech kind of companies, many of which have gone on to do quite well. So things like Notion or Deal, great companies. I was also doing a lot of frontier tech. So just things where, advances in engineering or technology let you do a thing that you couldn't do before. So this was things like genomics or self-driving cars or supersonic airplanes. And crypto was one of those areas. And so we were dabbling in that for a few years, Curtis and I were. And then when we left in 2016, We kind of found ourselves spending all of our time in crypto. You know, it just sort of felt to us like the most raw part of the internet. And it reminded us a lot of when we were much younger, when we were kids, sort of like the magic of the internet, where you could go into some chat room and, you know, nobody knew how old you were. It was just a handle. And you could have these discussions with people all over the world. And it felt like a lot of promise. You know, it kind of felt like, you know, the internet was going to democratize access to information and education. And, you know, we could all work at home and the best and brightest people in the world would have access to all these great resources. And, you know, we'd untap this global economy and like all this great stuff, some of which actually happened and, you know, it was accelerated by COVID. But some of it didn't happen. Like we ended up with these massive centralized entities that control so much of the internet and have so much money and power and influence. And the tools have been used for things I think that weren't originally anticipated, you know, in the early days of the internet. And so to us, it sort of felt like this combination of that same raw energy, but also this desire to maybe like reclaim what the internet was supposed to be about. And we kind of just loved that ethos. And so we were just hanging out in all these chat rooms and having fun with it through 2017. And then in 2018, we decided to formalize a lot of what we were doing into a firm called Electric Capital. And the thinking was, you know, we thought we would go start another company. We thought we'd do another startup. And what we realized was that, you know, we were doing all this investing. We could help a lot of people because we built and shipped products and scaled them. And that was actually a lot of where we were just spending time with the founders, is helping them think about how to, you know, build stuff and ship products and think about product strategy and a lot of the mechanics of how you actually do the actual startup or the protocol. And we said, you know, it'd be great to be able to do this at scale. It'd be great to be able to hire a team of people to support these founders, to be able to support these protocols. You know, at the time, a lot of the discussion was around layer one. And so we were like, you know, it'd be great to be able to hire some engineers and run some state, you know, nodes and be able to stake and help secure the networks. And to do that, it would be nice to have, you know, some sort of capital base to do it. So that's how Electric was born. And so it was a small fund in 2018, and we've since scaled it up to, you know, a couple billion in assets at this point. So we're a little bit bigger than we were even just 3 years ago. But yeah, that's crypto. Crypto grows and scales quickly. So that's kind of us.
Awesome. Well, appreciate the story to start out, and looking forward to digging into a couple of pieces there. One thing that I thought was particularly interesting, you mentioned sort of yourself and your co-founder, Curtis, thinking that, you know, seeing in crypto something similar to what you saw, you know, earlier on growing up in like the original internet and sort of the future and the promise of it and the ability to sort of democratize access and to things like education, all the things that you said earlier. But like you mentioned, that's not really the way that it played out, at least not in a lot of ways. And, you know, you have a pretty unique perspective having worked for two of the largest centralized players that sort of won this first iteration of the internet, if you will, Google and Facebook, respectively. So what's your sort of evaluation, like, you know, after the fact, like what happened to that future? And, you know, how do you think crypto is poised to maybe capture some of what you envisioned in the first place?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, like how did we end up with these big centralized powers? I think part of it is that, you know, the internet was these stateless transactions. And so the data that you needed to preserve state had to be captured in a database. And so this is, you know, like who are your friends, for example, and that database is proprietary. And so then the best business model became, how do you get all the data into one place and own that data and then monetize it? And that might be through selling access to it or, you know, by building algorithms on top of it. But that in effect became the business model of the internet as a sort of side effect of what was possible technically. And so when we think about Web3, I think what's really interesting is the idea that you have sort of shared state, like the blockchain is an open, publicly available database with a set of APIs and sort of standardized data formats, allows you to have the database get opened up and potentially behave more like a public good, such that that data doesn't serve as a moat quite in the same way anymore. Like you have transferability and transportability of that data. So imagine like if you could take your friend graph from Facebook and just take it with you and go to some other social network. And maybe that other social network has a different perspective on how to filter the news, or, you know, has a different set of algorithms for the newsfeed. And all of a sudden you would get a huge amount of competition that could happen on top of that data. And people would have to compete at that layer. And generally speaking, I tend to think that when you have a lot of competition, you get better goods and products and services. And so you might actually have what happened, you know, on the internet, but times 10, because all of a sudden you can enable a new kind of innovation. And so, you know, just that one technical change, I think opening up the data layer and allowing people to have access to it could potentially be a very, very big unlock in terms of, and change in terms of what the business models could be around it, because you sort of eliminate one of the business models. And, you know, kind of as an investor or as an early stage founder, when something like that happens, where you see, you know, something that was the core of a business, you know, sort of proprietary data, and you sort of flip it on its head and you say, it's no longer proprietary. In fact, it's now open and anybody can access it. Those kinds of platform shifts, where like a platform does the opposite of the previous generation of a platform, tend to be very, very disruptive. And so that sort of catches your eye, like your spidey sense starts tingling a little bit as an entrepreneur who's seen a few things, or as an early stage investor, that might be really disruptive. And I think when you couple that with the idea of tokens, which allow value and money to be exchanged, you know, 24/7 between people or computers and computers, you know, not just people and people, but, you know, people to computers or computers to computers, and create incentive structures around who has access to that data and what you can do with it and how you secure that data. That is really interesting, because that creates an entirely new business model. And so all of a sudden now the ability for money to flow peer-to-peer, directly tied to the data or directly tied to the movement of information, I think is a fundamental business model shift. And so now you don't have to have an ads-based business. You can actually have something where people can pay directly for some good or service that they want in a way that they can't be disintermediated. And so this starts to strike at like really the core of the business models of the internet. And now what you might have is a technical architecture that allows you to build products slightly differently in a way that is potentially very disruptive to the core business model of Web2 companies, but also you have the ability to monetize that in a totally different way. And I think that is a killer combination. The fact that you have like a technical architecture that's different, plus the ability to monetize it in a different way, is potentially, you know, that sniffs very, very disruptive to me. And so when I play that forward, I think, you know, today it's starting with layer one and DeFi, because it's sort of, you know, if these tokens are some form of value exchange and some form of money in some sense, not for a strict definition of money, but value exchange, it makes sense that people would build protocols to move that money around. But I think when you play this forward, the primitives that we're creating around decentralized computation, decentralized data storage, open access to the data, the ability to pay people for access to compute or data, and to do it in very small increments in real time, 24/7, all of those basic primitives to me actually sniff like over the next decade, we reinvent big chunks of the internet, and we reinvent them in this different way, where actually your data is not seized and captured by a third party. And because the data can't be seized and captured and is effect default portable, you might get a very different sort of topology that it you know, emerges, like, and who has power in that ecosystem might look very, very different. And so what that could mean, for example, is you could own all your own data on a secure enclave on your phone and then choose which social networking application you want to have access to your data. And maybe they even have to pay you for it, right? Because they're going to monetize that somehow. And so there can even be new forms of, you know, monetization for the end user that are actually even more beneficial. So anyway, we're in the very early innings of this, but that's how we sort of think about it at a high level, is like, you know, it sort of, we're engineers. So we sort of approached it from that technical lens of like, oh, this is a different way to build, you know, the architecture of how to build an application, but actually that infrastructure could be very, very disruptive over the next 10 years.
Right. So we're going to spend some time, of course, talking about crypto and how it can be so potentially disruptive. But before we get there, we'd like to spend a little more time on the potentially disrupted. So especially the companies that you've got experience with, Google and Facebook, of course, you know, they could make various adjustments to their business model or, you know, change of focus. Of course, like, you know, Facebook focusing on the metaverse now, changing the name of their company. But having been inside both of those organizations, I think Facebook more recently than Google, and even, you know, interacted, I understand, like directly with people like Larry and Sergey and Zuckerberg at Facebook, as well as a bunch of other people in sort of leadership positions there. How do you think they're going to react? I know it's a little bit speculative, but like, are these companies sort of dead in the water, or is there a chance that Facebook actually does sort of win out, for example, like the metaverse that people are sort of waiting for and envisioning that hasn't seemed to arrive yet, but it seems to be gaining some steam lately? How do you see these tech titan companies like FANG companies sort of surviving or otherwise in sort of this crypto rise?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And of course, nobody really knows the answer. I think if you look at history and technology history, It's rare that a company is able to make a transition through a platform like this. More often than not, companies that were really big on the prior platform tend to miss the next platform. So a classic example might be something like Microsoft and mobile, or Intel and mobile compute, right? They really missed the boat relative to ARM or Qualcomm. And in part, I think it's because when you see something that is disruptive, often what's happening, and we throw that term around a lot in tech, but you know, often what's happening is you have something that in the early days looks inferior to what you're currently doing, but actually does meet some real need. And that need starts as a niche market, and then it grows tremendously and very quickly, and it grows far more quickly than anybody had anticipated, to the point where it is a meaningful market. But by that point, it's a little too late because the incumbents have built up their entire businesses in sort of the prior market. And switching that to a new market, it can be often very, very challenging. And not just from like a technology perspective, but really from a human perspective. You know, like when a platform changes, you also have to change how your business works and how your organization works around that technology. So to use a concrete example, you know, like Walmart has known that Amazon is just on a tear for like 30 years now. Right. It's, Amazon is not a young company. It's a 30-year-old company at this point. That's kind of like when Amazon was getting started in, so where are we? We're in 2021, right? So yeah, it's like a, you know, 27-year-old company. So it's something like when Amazon was getting started, you know, there were companies that were started in like 1967. That's like the equivalent, right? To just put it in a context, which is wild. And so, you know, Walmart has known that this company is on a tear for the last 30 years. And Walmart has known that it's on a tear for 30 years, and like, why haven't they been able to do something about it meaningfully? And in my opinion, the reason is that changing the human organization around the technology is really, really hard, right? At Walmart, who has all the power? It's like the people who have the retail relationships and the people who have, you know, the relationships with Procter and Gamble, and they understand how the supply chain works. Like, that's who has all the power. And at Amazon, who has all the power? It's the engineers. So is Walmart able to disrupt its organization internally such that the engineers have all the power, right? That's actually really hard. And so often the human organization changing is the hard part. And that's why when technology companies experience a platform shift, like figuring out how to change your human organization ends up being very hard. Now, I think the one exception to this rule are founder-led companies, because founder-led companies tend to have moral authority. Like the founder has moral authority inside the organization. And so the founder can just say, no, we're not doing that anymore. And now the company's going to do this. And if the reason is why, the answer is because I think it's the right thing to do. And so, for example, if you look at Facebook, you know, Facebook started as a desktop web company. And even by about 2012, around the time of the IPO, a very small percentage of Facebook's revenue came from mobile. And what Mark did was he basically pivoted the entire company and said, we are now a mobile first company. And the way he enforced that was really interesting. He would do things like, this is not the only thing he did, you know, had to retool the organization and build a bunch of engineering capacity and teach designers how to be mobile first and so on. But, you know, there were subtle things that he could do that really enforced it top down. So for example, if you went into a meeting with Mark and you showed him any mockups, if you showed him desktop mockups, the meeting was instantly over, right? That was it. Meeting's done, adjourned, like everybody leave. And so all of a sudden, like you just didn't show desktop mockups anymore, right? And if you didn't show them in a meeting with Mark, like why would you show them in a meeting with the VPs? Because they're not going to go to Mark anyway, right? And so all of a sudden you could pivot the company very quickly to mobile. And so the company was able to transform itself. So I wouldn't rule out Facebook. And in fact, I think a lot of people have lost a lot of money betting against, or maybe not made as much money as they could have, you know, betting against Zuck. And so I tend to think like you probably don't want to, there's like a handful of people you really don't want to bet against, you know, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg. If you bet against them, you probably lose. So I think Meta is maybe one of the few companies that might be able to pull it off just because Mark wants it badly enough, which I think is really impressive that he's as motivated as he is, you know, this many years into him having built this company. Now, does that necessarily mean that Meta's version of the metaverse will emerge? Not necessarily. Right. I think there are, you know, at least two competing worldviews for how this is going to happen. I think there's a step function worldview, which is something like what, you know, Oculus is envisioning. You have sort of a headset that you're going to wear. There's going to be VR. It's a whole new computing platform. You know, there's presence. maybe NFTs and crypto get baked into that somehow. You might have native cryptocurrencies to enable transactions, or you have NFTs that are part of this whole ecosystem. But it's really like the compute platform shift through VR that I think, you know, Meta is really pushing. And then I think there's a slightly different worldview, which is the one that I tend to subscribe to, which is we're already in the metaverse. We just don't have something strapped to our heads yet. Like, you just think about where you spend most of your day as a you know, member of the internet these days, it's probably online. You know, you like to sleep for 7 or 8 hours a day, and you're probably online for like 12 hours a day. So you're actually probably spending more time in the metaverse than you are awake, right? When you take out sleeping. So, you know, I think we're already in the metaverse, and then we're sort of incrementally moving our way towards that sort of just getting enmeshed in our lives, and that the compute, you know, the window, the screen that we look at that metaverse through is going to be the less interesting part of that transformation. Right. So it doesn't matter if it's a laptop or a mobile phone or something strapped to your head, but that is the less interesting part of it. The more interesting part is all the cultural and social dynamics that are happening around things like cryptocurrencies or NFTs or communities on the internet or DAOs. All of those things are really what are going to define what the metaverse looks like. And that's happening today anyway. And in that world, certainly I think Meta could play an important role, or Google could play an important role, or Netflix could play an important role. But I think they end up playing not the defining role. Like, I think the crypto native companies end up being the defining companies, in the same way that, you know, Microsoft was an important company on the internet, and they've become more important with things like Azure. But they're, I wouldn't suggest that they're the most important company on the internet. But you know, time will tell, right? You know, I think if I were to play the other side of it, what would Facebook, or what would Meta, or what would Mark say about it? Well, you know, Apple was able to transform itself. Apple became perhaps the most important company because they transitioned the world to mobile, and they made that happen after being a very major player in the PC revolution. And they were able to do that in part because Steve Jobs was there. So again, kind of this idea of founder-led companies, because founders have moral authority, can sometimes make these transitions. It's rare, but if anybody's going to pull it off, it's going to be a founder-led company. So, you know, it's certainly possible that I think Meta pulls something off, and they do, you know, what Apple did in the last platform shift.
Yeah, it's a really interesting perspective. I definitely agree with sort of the founder point, especially guys like, you know, Steve Jobs, Zuck, sort of generational type of founders, not just like any founder. And sort of it does sort of help, I think, to see that Zuck, to your point, already transitioned Facebook to a mostly mobile company. Instagram, I think, is, I don't know if it's like the majority of the volume of their value, the majority piece of their value these days, but at the very least it's a large piece. So they've sort of reinvented themselves a couple of times, and certainly says something that this time is the first time that they've actually changed their company name about it. And like, no, you know, they're not hiding anything. They call themselves Meta. Everyone's talking about the metaverse. It's like a pretty clear direction that they're setting for themselves. So it'll be interesting to see. Speaking more on like, you know, you've talked about a couple of like really impressive people now that you've worked with in the past, Zuckerberg being one of them. I mentioned Larry and Sergey earlier, from your earlier experience at Google. I think you worked like directly with Marissa Mayer as well. Maybe with Sheryl Sandberg, a little bit at Facebook, just sort of the sheer exposure that you've had to these like extraordinary tech leaders, and generally like entrepreneurs and leaders, what was like, what did you learn from all that exposure? Like, what were some similarities you saw between people like this, some differences, like outstanding features that maybe Zuck had something about him that like you didn't really see in Larry and Sergey or something like that? I'm just curious, because not a lot of people have that sort of exposure over their career.
Yeah, it's been pretty wild. It's I'm very, very fortunate to have had access to all those people. It's just one of those like right place, right time things. It's just like Google was the first place I worked, and it turned out being at Google in the mid to late 2000s, kind of like that 2005 to 2010 era, was an amazing time to be there, because the organization was still so small, and it was, I don't know, when I joined, it was like 3,000 people. And so, yeah, my first manager was Marissa Mayer, who's gone on to do amazing things. And, you know, he had access to Larry and Sergey and Eric, and Sundar was just, was not CEO of Google yet. Sundar was just this senior PM that you sat next to on the couch while you were waiting for Marissa. You know, it was a wild time. And same thing with Facebook, right? It's just like all these leaders there were, you know, they were not sort of who they are today. I think, you know, having had the good fortune to have seen a lot of that, I think probably my biggest takeaway actually is that, most of these people that, you know, from arm's length look superhuman are actually not. And I don't mean that in any sort of derisive way. It's, I think it's remarkable what all these people have accomplished and, you know, what their skill sets are and how talented they are. So it's not intended as a slight against them in the least. But I think what I realized was I've met a lot of people in my life that are of that caliber. And one of the big unlocks for all of these people was that they had the good fortune to find something that they really believed in, and have people who supported them, early, and get a little bit of luck flowing their way. And the combination of those things created this feedback loop where they had, you know, increasing amounts of success and they believed that they could be successful and they believed that they could accomplish great things. And they had people around them who believed they could accomplish great things. And that actually is a really, really big unlock. You know, I think when you look at a lot of, there are people that, you know, like as an angel investor I've invested in, and you kind of look at who they were when they started and who they become by the time everybody learns about their billion or $5 billion or $10 billion company. And it's really impressive who they became, but they didn't start as that person. And so one of my biggest takeaways from having worked with all these amazing people is that the amount of human potential in the world, we're probably only tapping like 1% of the human potential in the world, because most people are actually capable of a lot more than they think they're capable of. And what they need is just to believe that. And then what they need is some people around them that believe that. And then you do need access to certain resources like, you know, a good education and capital and a little bit of luck. But it's actually really inspiring, because I think you realize that it's not like the Elon Musks of the world are somehow, you know, rare breeds. It's actually that, like, we could have 1,000 more people like that very easily. And then we could have like millions of people who are, you know, doing remarkable things in the world, if only we had systems that created those kinds of people, right? If only we had systems where people actually got great educations and could get access to capital. And there were enough people who believed in other people, and you had enough people who believed in themselves. And so that actually takes you to this place of realizing that actually not a huge amount of capital is necessary. And actually most of the world's potential is actually untapped right now. And that actually we could have, you know, 1,000 more great leaders like that, or we could have millions of more entrepreneurs, and actually the world could support all of that, because actually probably the number of opportunities that are unpursued right now is in the millions. Like, there are probably millions and millions of great ideas that we just haven't had the founders go pursue yet. So anyway, I don't know if that's what everybody would take away from that necessarily, or what you were intentioning, but like my biggest takeaway was actually, these people are remarkable, but actually I think we could have, you know, we've probably only created 1% of the remarkable people in the world that we should have created. Like, we actually should create 100x more remarkable people. And if we could figure out how to unlock all that, we'd actually unlock a lot of human potential, and we'd accomplish great things. You know, like, imagine if there were 1,000 SpaceX caliber companies, or, you know, 1,000 people working on, you know, scientific research, or 1,000x the people, you know, trying to solve clean energy problems, or, you know, just like the amount of amazing things that we could do, I think would, you know, we just haven't figured out how to do that yet. It's actually one of the reasons I feel like I find a great deal of satisfaction doing what I do, is like, in effect, the way I think about my job is finding these people who have so much potential that they don't even realize how much potential they have, and giving them just a little bit of money and a little bit of advice and a little bit of support along the way, in hopes of unlocking all of that potential. And it happens, and it's remarkable to see when it happens. I mean, I look at somebody like Blake Scholl, who's a founder and CEO at Boom Supersonic, and they're building a supersonic airplane. And Blake is an old friend of mine, and it's just remarkable to see how far he's come in the last few years. And I think, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, people are going to be talking about Blake as like the next Elon, because he'll have, you know, willed supersonic flight into existence as a founder. And I know Blake, and I think he's a great example of that. Blake is a very smart guy. He just, you know, if you look at his prior track record, you know, he struggled with his previous company because he had a sort of mobile e-commerce shopping app, and it just wasn't the thing that he was put on earth to do. And when he found the thing that he truly, truly believed in, he just moved mountains to make that company exist. And, you know, I think is going to change the course of human history as a result. And I think it's like a fascinating case study in how much untapped entrepreneurial energy and potential there is in the world.
Yeah, it's a super interesting takeaway. I don't know if that's to your point, like you said, you know, if that's what most people would take away, but I think that's like a super like layer zero, I guess you could say. I'm borrowing that term from like crypto, or they say it's like what's under the layer one of like Bitcoin, sort of like the people. I think that's like a very layer zero perspective that you gave on sort of some of the commonalities between these sort of legends that you worked alongside with sort of before they were legends in a way. And I think it is extremely hopeful and like optimistic, the point that you make. It's really like sort of remarkable how these people, you know, they do, from the outside looking in, they do just look like superhuman, especially like someone like Zuck. But, you know, he still has 24 hours in the day. Elon Musk still has like 24 hours in the day, and they just have to figure out how to make things work. And there's presumably, like you said, like just a ton of belief behind it. And so some luck and some smarts and maybe a lot of both, but either way, it sort of makes it happen. I'm going to ask you like somewhat of an impossible question to answer maybe, but I'd like to sort of hear where you might go with it. You did, I think, the startup that you spent the most time working on, I believe, was education focused with online learning. And that, you know, seemingly would have to have some sort of, would say play some sort of role in helping that, you know, 10x, 100x, 1000x, 1000000x people realize the potential that they're capable of, but they just, for whatever reason, can't really fulfill at this point. What do you think could be an element or two of the solution to sort of untap some of that human potential to go from maybe 1% to even just 5% or 10%?
Yeah, it's a good question. So for context, the startup that I started, the idea was to use machine learning and really basic techniques, statistical techniques, to personalize content delivery for education. And it was actually quite effective. I mean, in V1, all we really did was we could assess very quickly the things that you knew already and then just not bore you by removing that content. So like, if you already know how to add, we don't need to show you a bunch of content on how to add. Let's like move you on to subtraction. And if you already know addition and subtraction, let's just move you on to multiplication. And it turns out just like doing that makes people way more engaged, because now you're not boring them with stuff that they already know. So that was like the high level insight.
I was just going to say, at the same time, you're not challenging them so badly that like they can't do the thing and it's just like they sort of quit, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so there's a whole like set of other, you know, how do you make it actually personalized? How do you like challenge them in the right ways? And like you can get increasingly sophisticated on these things. But it turned out just like doing some really basic stuff had like pretty significant improvements. But at the end of it, what we realized was no matter how good we made the software, we were not going to be able to solve the systemic problem around the delivery of the software, which is to say that so much of what happens, we were sort of really targeting US K-12 education and really focused more on like 8-12, so 8th grade to 12th grade. So much of what happens in the US public education system has misaligned incentives around the software, that no matter how good your software is, you're not going to be able to fix some of the fundamental problems. Now, some of those problems are societal problems. You know, like what do you do in a situation where you have a disadvantaged community and both parents have to work, and so the oldest sibling has to take care of the two youngest siblings after school? Like, does that 13-year-old that needs to take care of the 9-year-old and the 7-year-old when they come home from elementary school and make sure they get home and get fed, and then, you know, does that person have time to do their homework? Do they have time for extracurriculars? Do they have time to read and study? You know, so there are definitely like structural societal problems, and those are very, very challenging. And then the other big sort of challenging problems around the software is just the incentive structures in schools. And what do we ask of the different constituencies? And who has an incentive to try new things and try new models and take risks? And how do we reward that? And it turns out in the American school system, one of the biggest challenges is that there is not an incentive structure to take risk and to try new things. Because if you try new things and they don't work, often you get punished, right? You're not really rewarded for it. Like if you do a way better job as a teacher and you have, you know, a 2x improvement, like, do you really get paid more? Do you really get rewarded in a meaningful way? Do you get accolades publicly? You know, like the incentive structures just don't reward that. And there are massive incentive structures for disrupting the status quo. And so you kind of have a system where the ecosystem around the student is not really setting them up to be able to fix the fundamental problems. And what you have is a system that was really designed in like the Industrial Revolution to, you know, to produce certain kinds of workers. And that's not the ecosystem that we live in anymore. And so this then I think comes to like a philosophical question of, do you try to reform the system from inside, or do you try to say, you know what, the system is you can't be reformed and we just need to go outside the system. And after many years of trying, I came to the conclusion that actually trying to reform the system from the inside was just too slow. Like it just was not going to happen. There are too many entrenched interests in that. Everything from how, you know, funding works for public schools to how teachers are compensated to, you know, what the incentive structures are for trying new things, like just all the way down, the incentive structures are misaligned to actually try new things and take big risks and see, you know, big change. And so really the way to succeed is to sort of circumvent the system altogether. So for example, I think things like Lambda School, very interesting, right? Let's just like sidestep the entire system. Things like Y Combinator, right? Instead of going to grad school, we'll give you some money and you can just tinker with it. And you effectively get a PhD in the thing that you're tinkering on, except you got paid to do it instead of having to like struggle through and pay to do it. What Peter Thiel is doing with the Thiel Fellowship. Like I think, you know, most people don't realize, but Vitalik was a Thiel Fellow. And so he came up with Ethereum as a Thiel Fellow, or Dylan Feld, who started Figma, which is a $10 billion company. And so you can have like pretty dramatic influence if you sort of like sidestep the system, I think. And so I've come to believe actually what we need to do is have a lot of experiments happening outside the normal K-12 education system. And in many of those cases, actually, if you could have alternative means of making the business model work, it doesn't even have to be a great business model. It can just sort of be a break-even one, or, you know, as Thiel is doing, it can be philanthropic. Like he didn't make any money off of Figma or Ethereum. But actually, like, it doesn't take a lot of dollars to do it. What we really need is experimentation happening. But that experimentation likely needs to happen outside of the K-12 boundaries for us to really see meaningful breakthroughs. Because the system itself is just so entrenched in so many ways, that until we sort of move outside the system, we're not actually going to be able to experiment in any meaningful way.
Yeah, I think, first of all, a really interesting perspective, but I think the Thiel Fellowship in particular is sort of a point that that supports what you were saying earlier about like the extreme level of potential that might be out there untapped. It could be that we're only tapping 1% just by the fact that he invested in like 20 or 25 people a year, and yeah, you know, for not that many years, and resulted in people like Vitalik and Dylan and Laura Deming and many more. It's just like sort of hard to believe until you consider the fact that like maybe they were tapping into this other thing where they're just tapping a whole lot more of the potential that exists out there by smart people in the world, by giving them a little bit of money and a little bit of support to sort of believe that they can do more than they might have thought previously. I would be remiss not to cover crypto. I know we've spent a lot of time on some other things, but it was really interesting stuff. But I do want to talk about crypto a little bit, what you're focused on mostly today with Electric. There's a couple questions that I sort of came in with that I particularly wanted to run by you, just given listening to you on other podcasts and reading some of what you've written about. And I think the first thing that's an interesting perspective that I've considered, but haven't heard a whole lot about anywhere else, is this concept that like we could potentially be in like a MySpace era of crypto, where everyone's talking about like, oh, it's too late. Even in like 2017, 2018, people are saying like, oh, it's too late. After that whole hype cycle or in the middle of it or whatever. And now a lot of the same people, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, it's sort of like too late. Like you can't get the 100,000X or 10,000X or even 1,000X Bitcoin anymore. And same with Ethereum maybe. But it seems not totally out of the question to me that it could be too early, that Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever sort of is dominating today could be MySpace. And we're sort of yet to see the Facebook of sort of the crypto era. Is that, maybe I'm sort of putting words in your mouth and I certainly don't mean to, but what are your thoughts on that and sort in terms of like the timing of where we are in the lifespan of crypto?
Yeah, well, all good thoughts. Another way to think about it that I've been sort of talking about more recently too is, you know, if you just look at the numbers, I think Coinbase at their last earnings call had something like 65 million users. And that's accounts, that's not like monthly actives. And Facebook has something like 3 billion monthlies. So you're just talking a totally, literally, you're talking two orders of magnitude difference, which means we're something like 1 or 2% of the way there. And that's like really hard, I think, for most people to get their heads around, because I think humans, you know, we're not really wired for exponential growth. Like intuitively, we don't understand exponential growth because we're biological, like macro biological entities. And you don't really experience exponential growth at the macro biological scale. Like you do with the bacteria or the virus scale. But the example I always use is like, you don't go to sleep one day and then you wake up tomorrow and there's just like a giant tree outside your window that was a seed yesterday, right? Like you just don't experience exponential growth as a biological entity. And so our brains are not set up for that. And not only are brains not set up for exponential growth intuitively, we also are really bad at large numbers. You know, like as primates, we can like tell the difference really fast between like 2 and 4 or like 2 and 8, but like a pile of 123 versus a pile of like 400, we're kind of bad at. That's why you have those like jelly bean in the jar guessing games, right? Because like as monkeys, we're just like bad at guessing beyond like 50. Not only that, but we're bad at low probability events. Like our brains are not wired to handle this properly, right? So what's an example? Like people worry about plane crashes and they don't worry about driving their car, when statistically you're way more likely to get hurt in your car than you are on a plane, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're just bad at low probabilities. So you take these three things together and you say, we're bad at exponential growth. Our brains are bad at, you know, large numbers, and our brains are bad at low probability events. And it turns out these early stage markets, like startup technology markets, are the intersection of all of those three things, right? They're low probability events of success with like really large markets when you're talking about enormous numbers, like in the trillions of dollars. And it's all about exponential growth. And so in general, I think our intuitions about early stage markets are just really bad. And you have to like unlearn a bunch of what things feel like intuitive and actually like do the counterintuitive thing a lot of times. And so whereas it feels like we may be, you know, we're 10 years into this, you know, 13 years into this crypto ecosystem, and, you know, like several years into Ethereum, and like, look at all the stuff that's happened. I suspect we're really underestimating how big these things are going to get. And I think we're really underestimating how large these ecosystems are going to get and how much they're going to matter. You know, another way to think about it is like, we have a tendency to look back at history and say, oh, that was exponential. Like you look at the growth of the internet and you're like, wow, that was exponential. That's crazy. And then when you project forward linearly. And this is always the mistake that people have made for the last 20, 30, 40 years of technology. Like you can see it's exponential behind you, but you're not willing to extrapolate exponentially in front of you because that just feels ludicrous. And so if you were to play that forward, you might end up with crazy math. You might end up with something that says like, you know, the crypto ecosystem is going to be worth $100 trillion or $200 trillion. Or that something like, you know, and this is obviously not financial advice in any capacity or form. But, you know, you might look at what you think is going to be a digital store value, something that might be a digital gold. And you might say, well, you know, could it be bigger than gold? Could it be worth 20 trillion instead of 10 trillion? Or could it be worth 50 trillion? That seems ludicrous, right? That a thing that's only been around for 20 years might be worth 5x more than the market for a thing that's been around for 5,000 years. That seems like a ludicrous statement, but it might actually be true. And actually, the history of technology would tell us that actually probably a lot of that is true, despite how crazy it sounds. Probably a lot of those statements are more likely to be true than not. And so then you play that forward and you say, well, if that's true, is the way that we're building stuff today actually the right way? If we're only 1% of the way there or 2% of the way there, is it possible that when we get 5 or 10% of the way there, we realize that the way we've been doing things is just wrong? And actually, we need to change up how we're doing them more fundamentally. And I don't think that's out of the question either. And so it's entirely possible that 3 or 5 years from now, you know, when these things are worth 10 or 20 or 30x more, you know, DeFi is worth $1 trillion instead of 100 billion, or, you know, there's $5 trillion of stable coins, you know, instead of 100 billion, what, you know, pick whatever metric or usage you want to pick. Is it possible that when we're 10 or 20x bigger, that all of a sudden we look around and say, ah, you know what, we kind of screwed that up. We should actually do this a different way. And so I think there's actually a pretty significant non-zero chance that that's the case. And then the example people always use is something like MySpace versus Facebook, because people forget that, you know, when Facebook started to really take off, MySpace already had 80 million users. So to put that into context, right, MySpace had more users than Coinbase does at the time where Facebook got started and started to disrupt them, right? Just to tell you how early we are, right? Like Coinbase doesn't have as many users as MySpace did. I mean, you know, to be fair, it's different user definition, right? KYC users on a financial product versus, you know, people signing for a social network is apples to oranges, but you get the idea just in terms of like how early we are. And so, yeah, I don't think it's out of the question at all. And I think it all comes from this sort of belief that I have that our intuitions around so many of these things are just so flawed that whatever your intuition says, you actually want to step back and say, well, maybe the opposite is true. And in a lot of cases, actually, because of these sort of weird biases that the human brain has, I think actually the opposite ends up being true.
Right. Yeah, that's a really interesting take. And I guess I'm curious to take it one step further and understand how you're, you know, given this context, how you're, you know, operating as an investor in the crypto space. Another analogy, you know, there's like the MySpace Facebook thing. Something I've thought about is like, imagine just like a horse race. And if you're 70% of the way through a horse race and like, you know, one of the horses is twice as far as the next best horse, which is six times as far as the horse behind that, that's like roughly equivalent to like Bitcoin market cap to Ethereum to everything behind it. You know, obviously like the first horse is going to win that race. And in technology, traditionally, it's been like because of network effects, there's like a power law distribution where there's maybe one big winner or a few winners that are degrees of magnitude behind each other or something like this. But if you're 1% into the race, it doesn't really matter if like one of the horses is twice as far as the other one. Could be that a horse that hasn't even like gotten off the starting line yet is the big winner. So how do you think about like, I think a lot of people sort of take for granted Bitcoin, they take for granted Ethereum. And they assume like, you know, you said we might rebuild things in a few years, but they assume like everything built now is sort of, you know, the more that gets built in, like the more that's here to stay, and there will be projects that fail, but generally like we're right on the right path. But what if we are like 1% as an investor, like how do you sort of protect yourself from the possibility that perhaps almost nothing that exists today is going to be like those fundamental big winners? Or do you make exception for like Bitcoin as maybe the winner of store of value, or Ethereum is the winner of like the main smart contracts protocol. How do you think about all that?
Yeah, I love that analogy, by the way. I think it's a good one, the horse race one. That's a good, clean way to think about it. So you know, the way you do it as an investor is you have to think probabilistically. Like, I think you can't be tribal about it. And I think you can't be a maximalist. And I think you can't be absolute about these things. And so what you have to say is, okay, well, What is the likelihood that this thing that's competing with Ethereum or that you know, is competing with some existing DeFi protocol, what is the probability that this thing might win, right? Is it 10%? Is it 1% that this new thing wins? Is it 0.1%? Like, what probability? It's more than zero. We know that it's, you know, not zero in most cases. Again, as like the history of technology tells us, that new things come in all the time, and markets change, right? The type of market participant, the user that is going to be here and 5 years looks very different from the type of user that was using DeFi or using crypto 5 years ago, right? 2016 versus 2026 users are going to be very different. So, you know, entirely possible that that happens. And so it's really a question of what probability do you put against it? And then against that probability, you have to look at the market size potential. And you have to say, is the price that I'm paying today for an investment, given the probability of success and the potential size of this as a winner, does it make sense? Can I actually, given those numbers, make a case that I might 100x my investment? And if the answer is yes, you probably should consider it, right? In a venture portfolio, at least. And it's a very particular style of investing, right? It's a particular style of investing that says, I'm willing to take a bunch of 1% bets, things that might only have a 1% chance of winning or 1 to 10% chance of winning. But when I stack enough of them, one of those things will hit and that thing will 100x and that will return the entire fund. And if you're good at spotting those kinds of things, you can actually build a track record doing that. And that's essentially what we've done as angel investors and as venture investors now, is you build a track record of year after year doing that. And some of your things do fall apart and they don't work. And a couple of your things really hit. And the things that really hit in aggregate more than make up for the things that don't. Back to your sort of intuition about the power law. And so, yeah, you actually, as a venture investor, if you think there's a 1% chance that a thing might work, it's really a question of price, right? Like if there's a, you know, to use an extreme example, there's a 1% chance that the thing might work. And, you know, that thing is valued at $1 million today, but you think it might be, you know, capable of taking out Bitcoin because of technical merit and the team behind it. And who knows, right? Whatever else, or Ethereum, or pick your favorite thing that you think needs to get disrupted. Then it might be worth doing, right? At that valuation, it might be worth doing. So it really ends up being a question of probability and price. More than anything else. And then you have to think that way as an investor. And then you constantly have to be paranoid about how the stuff that you do have conviction in is wrong. And so it's sort of this constant mind game of, you know, what do I have conviction in? And how might I be wrong? And then reevaluating all the things that you have conviction in to make sure that you still have conviction in them. And then placing a number of well-diversified bets in your portfolio so that any one of them returning the portfolios is possible. But it's a whole, I mean, it's a very, it's a weird industry in a lot of ways, because it actually flies in the face of a lot of conventional wisdom about how you should invest, because it's a very particular style of investing.
Yeah, that's a useful lens, I think, to look at it through. I tend to look at things in terms of like probabilities and potential myself, just like sort of managing my own little small amount of money. But I think given, you know, you're holding other people's money as well, and obviously investing that. And I think it's just, obviously there's a ton of upside and a lot of people are doing like really well, but I think it is like really challenging to operate in a space that's so potentially large with so many really interesting projects. And just like a lot, you know, it's moving so quickly and there's a lot of noise to like fight through. You know, certainly again, you know, large rewards, but challenging as well. I know we're coming up on time, so I'll make this the last question. I've heard you talk on like a number of podcasts about how, you know, there's a number of factors that you look for in founders. You know, the team might be great, the technology might be real, but if the token mechanics aren't there, you know, it's not something that you're comfortable investing in. And I want to just like better understand, and hopefully other people can kind of get better understanding as well of like how you think about looking at token mechanics and like how coins can, you know, or tokens can sort of accrue value. I think value almost as like a definition has just sort of gotten sort of mixed up with all these crypto projects going on. It's like everything is valuable now, it seems, even if there's like, if it's just like totally speculative or whatever. And I'm curious to hear like what you think is legit, what you don't think is legit. And if that's too broad a question, maybe you can just like pick an angle to go at it with.
Yeah, it's more art than science, all this token economic stuff. It is one of the interesting things, I think, in crypto that makes it really fun and intellectually interesting, because you don't know the answers in a lot of cases, you know, and people are constantly inventing new ways to do stuff. So even the idea of, you know, like liquidity mining, like putting assets into a smart contract and getting rewarded for it. I mean, whether you think it was like Fcoin or, you know, synthetics, that invented this a few years ago, it's a relatively new phenomenon, right? And so what's crazy about a lot of this token economic stuff is if you look at how the token economics were set up for projects in 2017 era versus 2019 versus today, it's evolved and it continues to evolve. And people are starting to get very clever about you know, who owns how much and making sure the community owns the vast majority of it. So you're rewarding community participants, you know, thinking about value capture in the right ways. So it's not just a pure utility token, but there's some sort of value that is accruing back to the token in some form, whether that's a buy and burn mechanic you know, some sort of assets that are sitting in a pool and your LP tokens entitle you to your pro rata share of those. And you can control where that liquidity goes. Like, people are getting really smart about how to use these tokens to sort of try to capture value in interesting ways. You know, I think there's still a long way to go. You know, I think if you look at, for example, some early data that's people are playing around with now about what do people actually do with the tokens that they get through LPing, and you just see that the vast majority of them are sold relatively quickly on market. And so, you know, I think like, for example, what ENS did with their airdrop and giving it to people who had been long-term ENS supporters, I think was really smart. Right. And so I think people are starting to get more sophisticated in sort of how they think about who to reward with tokens. And I think that's where it gets really interesting, because ultimately the goal of the tokens is to align incentives for the marketplace participants and reward the people who are doing the most work on your behalf in the marketplace. But we're still very early days in figuring out what exactly those models are. You know, I think there will come a day, I don't know, 5, maybe 10 years from now, where we'll have seen all of these experiments run in parallel. And we'll have a much better handle on, for certain kinds of marketplaces, what are good token models. You know, like, do you in fact want to give away 60% or 70% or 80% of the token supply to the network? You know, what kind of airdrops, you know, work really well? What kind of, you know, inflation rates work really well? You know, who you should give those inflation rewards to? You know, there are going to be a lot of, I think, open questions that all these layer ones and all these DeFi projects and all these protocols are sort of experimenting with. But I think it'll probably be another 5 years before we really start to see long-term which of these things works and which ones don't and why. And so I think it's fascinating. Like, nobody really knows the answers to this yet. And today we can reason through them, and it's evolving very, very quickly. And it's one of the harder things about being an investor in the space is just like understanding the history of all of these token economic models and what's worked and what hasn't and why. And then staying on top of all the experimentation that's happening. But I think we'll have a lot of clarity. And if I had to guess, we'll have a lot of clarity in 5 years because we'll have, you know, 7 or 8 years of history in some of these ecosystems. And I think we'll have a lot of clarity in like 10 years when we see sort of the Cambrian explosion we're seeing today. We have enough time for that to play out. And, you know, I think what'll be really interesting too is you just saw Ethereum go through this with, you know, EIP 1559 and sort of a fee change and gas change. You know, how some of these token models can evolve too. And so, you know, if you think a token model isn't working, can you evolve it towards something that is? And so I think that'll be really interesting too, to see which of these models various communities say, well, that actually feels like what we should do. So let's evolve what we have today to something better, and let's evolve it to that other thing because that's better for some reason. So I think all of that is going to happen in the background too. Like, I don't think these things are static. Like, just because you picked a token economic model doesn't mean you have to stick with it either. So all that experimentation and sort of convergence, I think, will happen over the next 5 to 10 years, and it'll be really interesting to see what comes out of that.
Yeah, I think the spark notes for this last portion of the conversation on crypto has basically been that it's still extremely early. I think I'm on the same page as you seem to be there. And for a lot of people, it's sort of scary to think about because it already seems pretty big and all over the place. But for others, like I'm sure you and I, it's really exciting to watch and thrilled to be a small part of it. Thank you. You know, we can close it there. I know we're running up on time, but thank you again, Avichal, for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'm looking forward to listening back myself and sharing it with others. But where can people go to follow you and Electric and see where all this goes over the years to come?
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. On Electric, you can just go to electriccapital.com. I'm pretty easy to find. And for me, I'm probably easiest, but, place is Twitter. So just @Avichal, @ my first name on Twitter.